Welcome to Season 2 of My Unknown Truth, a podcast sharing stories and experiences of adoption and foster care in Australia and around the world. My name is Nadia Levitt, and while exploring my own adoption journey, I wanted to create a space for others to share their stories too. In Season 2, I will be sharing fascinating personal experiences, some that unfold over long periods of time, and stories bravely told in memoirs and autobiographies. I discuss with a range of professionals in the field who may help navigate the complex foster care system, or understand childhood trauma and effects of separation, or how to support parents who wish to foster or adopt across the state, national, and international lines. By sharing a range of experiences, it may help increase connection and awareness around adoption and foster care in Australia, facilitate informed discussion, and encourage more people to open their hearts, minds, and homes to children in need. In this episode, I chat with Elizabeth. Liz is a mother to children through both adoption and foster care. Her background is in social work and training, where Liz has trained and assessed foster carers in preparation for children joining their families through the ACT Child and Youth Protection Services. She has also taught and assessed students when studying to become youth, mental health and drug alcohol workers. A former vice president of the Canberra-based Adoptive Families Association, Liz has contributed to establishing an annual teen camp for young adoptees, where she has facilitated support groups for parents of adopted teenagers. Liz is currently working in the adoption, out-of-home care, therapeutic parenting space. Let's get into it. So first of all, I just wanted to say hi, Liz, and welcome to the Australian Adoption Podcast. It's so good to have you speaking with us today. I just wanted to let the audience know just a little bit about your background. So on a personal level, you are a mother to children through both adoption and foster care. So you have that first experience parenting children from difficult beginnings. Is that one of the main reasons why you went into social work?
Yes, most definitely. I think at the time, my daughter, my first daughter, so I have three children, a 13-year-old, 19-year-old boy, 19-year-old girl, and my 19-year-old girl was probably two at the time, or quite young, and she'd been adopted as a seven-month-old. And we were really, my husband and I were really struggling with her behaviour. She had, as a seven-month-old baby, slept beautifully, ate beautifully. It was just such a joy after 7 years of wanting to be a parent. And, we'd obviously fallen in love with this little child. And then these terrible tantrums just erupted from her that would go for hours and hours. And I'm just struggling with how best to support this child. And I met a beautiful person in the adoption community at the time who started to teach me about trauma and attachment and you know, the implicit memory imprint on children and how it affects them and how it's coming out in her behaviour. And from that, I was a researcher anyway, and I always enjoyed that kind of academic side of things. And I really started to throw myself into it, and I thought, right, this is my passion. Now that I can say first comes pain, then comes passion, then comes purpose. And this was a really painful time in our lives because this little darling baby was just having such a hard time of things, and that continued on for several years. But I thought, I'm going to teach myself. I am going to throw myself into this and do the absolute best that we can possibly do for this child. So then I started to think about what I wanted to do, and social work seemed quite organic to me. I really liked the idea of kind of studying external systems and factors that influence and impact on people's lives, versus, say, psychology. And I also had a statistics, so there's no way I was going back and doing an entire psychology degree because I had statistics. So social work seemed quite natural for me to move into. And so I picked Monash University in Melbourne, and every assignment, every assessment, every piece of research that I did, I tried to choose adoption so that I could learn as much as I possibly could to help this little being. And then from there I went on and received my honours degree, and now I'm a mental health social worker. So I've gone more from advocacy and working with homelessness and domestic violence, those kind of things, early in my career, into the therapeutic space. I work with adoptive families. I work with children in foster care, as well as, you know, a broad spectrum of areas, I guess, but that's my passion.
That's so good. That's such a great explanation how you said pain, passion and purpose. That really resonates with me. Just going back with your 7-month perfect textbook baby and then that massive behaviour change. So that's obviously common for adoptive children or foster care children to, I guess, exhibit those outward symptoms, and then they somehow flick a switch and then they become, you know, some of them become severely dysregulated. You said to me before you wish that you had have understood how to address this child back then, and you said over the phone something happened in Hobart. Can you tell us about that?
So Hobart was where we moved to when our first daughter was about 1, and we lived there till she was about 4, and that's where I met the most amazing adoption community of families. And, you know, I think that's a really important message to get out to people, is that if, you know, you are bringing children into your family from these difficult backgrounds, to have that support network around you. So I was really lucky with that. But then I met this beautiful friend who actually had 2 children adopted from overseas, and one of them had reactive attachment disorder, which is quite a severe condition in terms of, you know, emotional dysregulation and violence, that kind of thing. And she was the one that taught me about, you know, cellular memory, that this little person of yours is struggling with these memories of what happened to her that she cannot recall. So it's difficult to process feeling. I know this now, I didn't know at the time, difficult to process what's happened to you if you don't have a memory of it. Mm. And it's stored in. Okay, so that's what was happening with her, and she was completely dysregulated. And, of course, then the attachment side came into it. Like, I could see that she wasn't attached, and this friend was explaining to me, when she runs away from you, you need to get her and bring her back, because she's not coming back to you. There's no circle of security. She's going out to explore the world, but she needs to come back to you for safety and security. So, but that's what she taught me, and I owe her so much for being able to sort of sow the seeds, I guess, for me to learn to understand. And, you know, when you become adoptive parent, sure, you go through a bit of training, you know, through different departments, but you, how do you reconcile that when your lived experience is this child that is having emotional breakdowns that last for hours and is throwing things at you and hitting you and biting you and just so dysregulated, and then you're becoming dysregulated yourself? How do you manage that? Those were the tools that I needed at the time, and that little community that I was in really helped start to embed that and to understand that, and then to go on and study what I've studied, and then hopefully impart that to other families, because it's so difficult, so difficult.
So how important is it to be trauma-informed when raising children from these difficult beginnings?
I think it is imperative. I really do. You know, when you're thinking about attachment, an attachment between a caregiver or a parent and a child being the template for all other relationships throughout your life, okay, very, very important. It's a dance of attachment. It's the attunement between the caregiver and the child. Now, trauma causes the numbing of emotions, okay? It also causes disruption of emotions, which will affect your ability to attach, okay? So it's understanding that, you know, I often liken it to a house. When you're building a house, you know, if the foundation's strong, then the structure will be strong. So with little people, and it doesn't matter if it's a child that, I mean, I have clients where the adoptive parents have been in the room when the child was born and handed over at birth. Those children are still being impacted. They're still impacted by the trauma of that rupture. Okay, so it's you know, and I'd say it doesn't matter how much love that child receives, how much care, you really need to understand that that attachment needs to develop, and it takes time, because that is what is going to imprint on that child's neurological systems, is that immense sense of safety, because that rupture in attachment, it is imprinting fear. Okay, and I think that's what was happening with our daughter, was that her system was completely overwhelmed by this terrible sense of fear that she couldn't articulate.
Like a somatic response until she learned how to verbalise her emotions?
Yeah, definitely. And so what we did at the time was try to contain that. So So there was a lot of holding. There was a lot of, you know, I'm not leaving you. You're throwing things at me. I'm not leaving this room. I am not going anywhere. So it's a lot of that co-regulation that we had to learn. And that's really hard for parents. If you have a child, you know, whether the child's 16 or three, you know, that upheaval and that dysregulation of emotion, you need to be able to co-regulate with that child and show them this is the way it's done. And I'm not leaving you. I am not going anywhere. I'm here. And to protect myself from those shoes that you're throwing at me, but I am here in the room with you, and I can hold your pain. That's kind of what it's about. I'm here for you, and I can hold your pain. I can hold your traumatic response because I'm not going anywhere. So it's not really about, well, it is about the behavior, but it's about asking, you know, people say, well, what's wrong with that child? Why is that child behaving that way? I think a way to change that perspective is to say, well, it's actually not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you? You know, and I don't know what happened in the prenatal period for my children. You know, I roughly know what happened in that first 6 or 7 months, and they received very good care, but there was no attachment. So, and that's why so many adopted children and children in care struggle with trust. And of course, from that then comes this huge sense of, I need to control my environment. I need to control everything because that's what makes me feel safe. And these maladaptive behaviors form from that. But it's getting underneath that. I have to rebuild that structure. I have to relay cement over that rickety foundation. How am I going to do that? And that's what I was learning with my daughter as a baby.
Yeah, I can imagine that it would be super helpful to just know that there is a reason that this stuff is happening, and it's at that cellular memory level. And the importance, like you were saying over the phone, it's, yeah, not what's wrong with you, it's what's happened to you, and understanding the development of the brain as well.
That's right. So if a child's constantly being thrown back into that primitive part of their brain, that fight or flight response in their amygdala is, you know, that part of the brain's firing, how can we calm that down? How can we help a child learn to access that more cognitive part of our brain? And often it's by calming the nervous system and calming the body first and foremost, you know, and I'll often see people with little 3 or 4 year olds in the supermarket, for example, throwing massive tantrums, and it's hugely embarrassing. And the parents are trying to talk the child around. And I often think, oh, the child can't access that cognitive part of their brain, because their brain, when it flips its lid, it can't access that higher level thinking when it's in that lower level thinking. So how can we do that? Well, we can hold the child. We can calm the child down. We can rub the child's back. We can sit with the child, because those words, oh, they're gone. But it's impossible to be in those two parts of the brain at the same time, particularly difficult for a child that's experienced disruption and a traumatic beginning. And I firmly believe that any form of adoption is a traumatic experience for a child, no matter how loving the act and how beautiful that life that child may then go on to live is still a traumatic experience.
Why should parents who raise foster or adopted children seek professional support and ongoing professional support throughout that child's life, especially into the teen years too?
I think it's especially important for parents to really look after their self-care. Really, really important, because if you're not doing okay, if you're not putting your oxygen mask on first, how are you going to support that young person in your life? Okay, really, really important. And if that means, you know, having someone to talk to, and I found that very, very helpful over the years, just having that weekly check-in, it's a hard week, this is what happened, what are some strategies you could have helped me with? I think that's very, very important. You know, there are a number of different types of therapeutic approaches that help with children, help regulate children, help with attachment. And I think for a lot of parents, it's not innate, but that traditional style of parenting doesn't often work for our children. So learning different strategies, different coping mechanisms, different ways of raising these children can really, really help. So I think that's what's important. And I also find, because I work with several teenagers in the care system, for them, having someone other than their parents or their carers to talk things through with is really beneficial as well. It just gives them that added extra adult in their lives, you know, and it really takes a village to raise a child. But for these children, gosh, that's definitely, definitely, it has to be part of your plan. You cannot isolate yourself, and you need to know what those supports are and how to access them. You know, it has to be a professional that either has an adoption background, which can be hard to find in Australia, or someone who with an experience of trauma, definitely.
So you're talking about therapeutic parenting style, and, you know, most parents probably haven't heard of that before, or you were saying it's seen as weak. Why is it seen as weak?
As I said, you know, that traditional style of parenting, where we're reacting to a child's behaviour, and where people feel that the child needs to have discipline around that, it's a different idea, I guess. I mean, discipline really means a learning experience, doesn't it, and teaching. It doesn't mean punishment. And I certainly found that people couldn't quite understand why my children weren't, I guess, traditionally punished for their behaviours. But the most important part about therapy, or one of the most important parts about therapeutic parenting, is remembering that there needs to be connection before there's correction. Okay, so you're developing attachment with this child, you're co-regulating with that child, you're trying to show that child there's a different way of doing things. Because often these children have an internal model of working that's very negative. There's a lot of pervasive shame. So it's not about I've done X and therefore I feel guilty, so my behaviour should be punished for that. Because often these children don't feel guilt, they feel shame, and there's a big difference there. I feel guilty because I stole that lolly from the shop versus I'm ashamed of myself, I'm a bad person. You know, I'm not innately good. You know, and that can come from, you know, a number of ways of thinking. I wasn't a good child. Is that why I was removed from my family? I wasn't a good baby. I'm not lovable because my birth mother couldn't keep me. These kind of, it's very, very, it's really stored in their bodies. So kind of avoiding that punitive approach, I guess, and focusing on that high structure, high nurture, which is what therapeutic parenting is all about. Lots and lots of nurture, lots of consistency, empathy, acceptance for where the child is sitting at that moment, because you're trying to help them develop their sense of security and trust in themselves and the trust in the world around them.
You mentioned some of the positive outcomes from this style of parenting. What has been some positive outcomes for you personally with your experience?
So I was thinking about this earlier today, and I was thinking what's a good example. And I was thinking of my daughter, my oldest daughter, who, you know, she slept with us or on the floor with us until she was probably 5 or 6, until her sister came along. That received a lot of negative thoughts from people. She's too old. She should be in her own room. But she was frightened of going to sleep. Okay, she had lots of terror around that, and she was very, very attached to me and found it quite difficult to remove herself from me. So we did a lot of that kind of co-sleeping, and she was with us for a long time. But I really put in the hard yards when she was younger, because she was such a poor sleeper. Even when she went into her own room, I would sit with her, I'd lie with her, and I would sing with her and read books until she calmed down enough to sleep. And that could be a couple of hours a night. And so I'd sing this particular song with her. It'd go on for a long, long time, an hour, 2 hours, until finally when she hit about 10, one day she said, I'm going to sleep, Mum and Dad, and she went off on her own. Now, that took 10 years for that child to finally feel safe enough to go and sleep in her room. But it wasn't until recently, and she's 19 now, so it's probably about 6 months ago, she said to me, you know, Mum, sometimes when I'm going to sleep, and if I'm worried about something or I can't sleep, I will sing that song to myself.
That's such a beautiful story.
Yeah, she still sings it to herself, and that's how she regulates herself.
I wanted to talk about, you know, using, I guess, your daughter as the example, because we have been speaking about her today, the outbursts and about not being able to verbalise how she was thinking and feeling, especially in those early years. So this is the first I've heard of pre-verbal grief. Can you explain the pre-verbal grief and maybe what that looks like?
Well, I guess that's talking about that memory, and we don't really develop memory as we think of it now, which is kind of in snapshots, until we're about 2 or 3. Okay, so the memory that we have prior to that is in our body. Okay, it's in our it's a cellular memory, I guess. So it's, you know, for a child that is removed for whatever reason from the birth mother they're connected to, you know, from the time of conception, whose heartbeat they've heard all through their lives that are, you know, born to that mother, held by that mother, and to be removed from that, how do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile that as a little person who's only feeling that? Can't verbalize it, can't really think about it, but still has to somehow process those feelings and those emotions. Well, it comes out in their behavior. It comes out in their fight or flight response. It comes out in exactly that, the way that they're displaying their emotions. Okay, so for my little girl, it was those terrible tantrums and anger, and the only way we could, you know, we had to try and contain her and be there with her. And it wasn't until she was about four that she broke down in the car one day and was crying, and I had to pull the car over, and I was talking to her, and she said, "I'm so sad. I'm so sad. I miss her so much. I miss my birth mother so much." And I thought, this is what has been happening. This is this terrible fear, you know, that she's felt in her body for so long. And I made the mistake of saying to her, "I know you do, sweetheart. I know you miss her so much." And she said, "How would you know what it feels like to miss her so much at the age of four?" And I thought, you're right. I didn't lose my birth mother at birth. You're exactly right. I don't know. But I do know now that that was that grief that you were feeling, and the, you know, the symptoms that were coming up were, it was fear and it was grief, and it couldn't be processed because you didn't know how. And so one of the techniques I used for her was teaching her about emotions. And, you know, we'd withdraw emotions and we'd throw them on the fridge, and she'd have to run to the fridge, and she'd have to smack on the fridge when she was feeling, you know, what am I feeling? I'm feeling angry. This is when she was about two. And I taught her to label her emotions and to be able to voice those emotions so that she could then start to talk about what she was feeling. But, you know, adoption really is a very, I think at times, a very disenfranchised grief. It's, well, you're very lucky, you're going to a good family, you're loved, you're cared for, you have a good life. But what about the life you had before? And what about the fact that there was no choice for you in those decisions? So it's not like when someone dies or you lose an animal, there's an obvious grief there, or if you're in, you know, bushfires, there's a communal reaction. Often these children don't have that. So they really need that supportive, therapeutic parenting to help them through that and to recognise that it is grief.
What about knowing about the child's developmental milestones in the brain, in the body, so that they are more equipped to care for them?
Okay, so one of the things, and one of the things that I find, I guess, a little bit challenging when working with parents is that often they'll, you know, and teachers, you know, they'll often refer to chronological age. Well, the child's 12 now, they should be able to go on school camp. The child's 15 now, they should be looking for a job. The child's five now, they should be able to play with other children and not snatch toys. And I often say, well, the issue there is that they may be at 12, but what is their emotional age? Are they more like a six-year-old? And children that have had disrupted attachment and had traumatic experience in their lives will often operate at a much younger age. I think that's part of what parents need to kind of be aware of, that if you have to keep your kindergarten child home from school another year because at four and a half, five, they're not ready to go, then that's okay. Because maybe they're not ready to go to school because they came into your care at the age of two. That's okay. Societal norms, maybe the children go to school at five, or maybe that's not the right thing for your child. Your child at 15, 16, they should be able, you know, starting to think about university or a trade or finding a part-time job. Maybe your 15, 16-year-old is still trying to regulate themselves and still trying to work out who they are, because their identity has been swamped by this trauma and these changes in their lives. Maybe they won't get a job until they're 18. Maybe they'll need to float along for a couple of years and then they'll choose to go somewhere else in life and take different paths. So I think that's an important part. Just remember, is your child maybe chronologically at this age, but where are they emotionally? And do we have to go back? Do we have to go back and treat that child as that young person, which is a big factor in adoption? You know, children will come home and one of the things that you can do to nurture attachment is to treat them like young babies. My children were carried for a lot longer than what you would be carrying a child because they hadn't been carried when they were babies. And the same with our son who came to us at 13. He would be very, very unhappy at 14 if it wasn't me who picked him up from soccer training, for example. You know, and parents will go, well, that's crazy. You know, he could walk home or he could get a lift with a friend. No, because we're building attachment. Just like a five-year-old wants their mum or dad to pick them up from the school playground, I had to be there on time or we would be in trouble.
Can you tell everyone about the annual camp that you established for young adoptive teens? This sounds really exciting.
Okay, so it was a joint effort, so I certainly didn't establish it on my own. It was I was part of an adoption group in Canberra that has been going for many, many years, and the president at the time was really clued into the fact that we had a lot of international adoptees because they tended to come in waves. You know, we had a lot of children at the time that were about 12, 13, 14, and they were starting to drift away from their adoptive peer groups. They didn't want to go along to Christmas get-togethers anymore. They wanted to be off with their own peers doing their own things, but they were disengaging from kids, from their friends within those networks, I guess. At a time when, you know, teenage years are identity seeking years, they're pushing boundaries. This was an area that maybe we needed to kind of focus on to you know, even if it was an annual event where they could get together and just be kids, internationally adopted kids with parents that look different to them, but that was the norm for the weekend. Okay, so try and re-engage these kids. So our president at the time did a fantastic job in kind of gathering the troops. And so he set up what was called Camp Chaos at the time, and invited parents from the area and from the region. We had families coming from New South Wales as well into Canberra, and we held a camp for children, all internationally adopted, from probably the ages of about 11, 12, up until about 16, 15, something like that. And it was just a community building event, really, where the kids could get together, they could bunk down together, the parents came along as well, so the parents could get together and talk about what was going on for them with their teens and all their complex issues. We'd often have a guest speaker come in, and I remember one year we had an ex-SAS soldier came in and talked to the kids about how tough the training was, which was an eye-opener for them all. But that was kind of about, you know, getting through the tough times, you know, and created lots of conversation amongst the kids and you know, he was a bit of a mentor for them, I guess, for the day. They did lots and lots of activities together, lots of group work, team building exercises, ate together, slept together, and left the camp feeling pretty good about themselves, because some of these kids really had become disconnected at a time when, as Gabo Mate puts it, you know, where parents and family need to matter more than peers, but in our society the peers take over.
Yeah.
At a very developmentally crucial time for these kids.
That leads to my next question about the importance of parents being around, especially through their teenage years, even though the teenager may not show signs that they want their parents. It's just being available and being there, being present. What sort of resources can you recommend for anyone listening that wants to know and read more about these topics today, or to read more about the teenage time?
So they did some research on boys, and they found that boys that were letting themselves into the house and parents weren't home until later in the evening were struggling with loneliness levels that equated to, elderly men living in nursing homes, or who had lost their wives, their partners. You know, and why is that when, you know, but my teen just goes into their bedroom and they don't want to come out, they just want to be with their friends. But what we need to realise is the teenagers still need those adults around to guide them and to help them, okay, and to be there for them. Even if you're just cooking in the kitchen, even if you're doing a Zoom call at work on the dining room table, there's still someone around. You're still checking, and if you can't do that, then checking in on them, meeting them when they get home. And even though they may rebuff that, it's really, really necessary. And there's a really good book that I'd recommend called Hold On To Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers by Gabor Mate and Gordon Neufeld. And that's what he talks about, how we need to reclaim our children from peers, because the peers don't have the answers. They're important, of course they're important, but the parents need to be the ones that are there for them. And pushing teenagers into independence too soon can create feelings of panic and can set children off. Having parents, you know, numbers in their phones, even though they will fight that, they will rebuff that, it's still setting up a boundary and an expectation, I've got you.
So you were talking just a little bit before about rupture, and there is that rupture and repair approach, and also the PACE parenting model, because you're trained in dyadic development psychotherapy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the psychologist behind that?
So Dan Hughes is, or Dr. Dan Hughes is an American psychologist who early in his career was working with children from hard beginnings, and he just felt that there was something missing in the treatment, that it wasn't working particularly well, whatever his methods were that he was using at the time. So he developed dyadic developmental psychotherapy, now I'm struggling to say it, and the approach is really based on a child's need for psychological safety. They are not going to develop, they are not going to attach if they don't feel safe. Okay, so this is kind of a model of intervention that he came up with. You know, underpinning that is, just because you take a child out of an environment that may be abusive or neglectful, doesn't mean the behaviours are going to go away, because they're still stored in their body. Okay, so he developed DDP, and it really is a style or a practice where the therapist works with the parents, okay, because that's the first step. And in an attachment model, you'll always work with the parents and the child, okay, not just with the child alone, and then send, you know, 1 hour of therapy a fortnight and then sending them home isn't going to really do a great deal of good if the child's attachment and dysregulation and those sorts of things are bubbling, okay. So working with the parents, encouraging motivation for the parents to work with, work with their child, you know, are they comfortable relating to that child on that in an attachment secure way? So not using those kind of traditional punitive approaches when children's behaviour is out of control, looking at the behaviour underneath that, co-regulating with the child. These are kind of things that you talk with the parents through. What are their own attachment styles? Are there triggers in their own attachment histories when the child's acting in a certain way? So being able to reflect on that and go, yeah, that's why I react so badly when this child swears at me and is really rude to me, because that wasn't something that was allowed in my house, and it was very firmly embedded in me that I did not do that. That's very triggering for me. So just, you know, reflecting on your own upbringing and style of attachment, teaching the parents how to co-regulate with the child. Can that child turn to you for comfort and safety no matter what they have done? Do they know that it's going to be a safe environment for them to talk things through, for them to come and say, I stole a car, Dad, and I ran into a tree?
You know, when they make a mistake, they tend to not want to say anything to their parents.
I'll give you an example. Was one young person that I was working with had been again suspended from school once again for punching a child and quite violent behaviour. Okay, now when I saw this child, it's quite dysregulated, quite upset. You know, you could see it in his body. He was fired up, he was puffing himself up. Now, this is a child that had, you know, considerable neglect and trauma, had been abused by big men, and that was his reaction, was to fight his way out of situations, okay, as a young teenager. Now, I could have said to, in my brain, I'm thinking, oh, not again, that poor other student, oh, this child is, you know, is he improving, he's so angry, you know, all this is going through my mind. But I had to calm myself down and say, well, not why did you do that? That's not okay behaviour. You know, you're going to get grounded when you go home, or whatever the kind of typical responses may be. My response was to calm him down, get him a drink of water, and then say, oh, she must have had a really, really hard day today. It must have been really, really hard to feel that angry. So validation and acknowledgement that he was out of control. And he was out of control because of what had happened to him in the past, and that was his go-to, you know, and that calmed the situation down. So that's that, you know, you have a rupture in your relationship, but you've got to repair it. But flip that around to, which is what you do with little children, you know, there's a rupture in someone, throw something all over the floor, or the child will get in trouble, and then you pick the child up and you comfort the child. This approach is make a connection before you correct the behaviour. Okay, so the connection was, I'm validating how you're feeling. That must have been so awful for you to feel that bad, that you felt that you had to hit someone. So it's that safe, warm environment. And that's what you know, the PACE model looks at, and that's what Dan Hughes kind of developed, okay, this system to comfort children and to validate the way they're feeling, okay, and then you're improving their psychological safety so that they can then go on to learn to modify their behaviour.
And you do have a private practice, speak with mainly adoptive and foster care families.
Mainly. Mainly. Yeah, it's a part-time practice, but that's kind of where my passion and my drive is. And so, yeah, I work with families. So, I mean, I will see children on their own, but then I'll always reconnect with parents. As the parents, yeah, it depends. It depends on the family dynamic. But it's the same issues that come up over and over again, is that attachment disruption, identity seeking as the children get older. You know, who am I? Where did I come from? You know, that feeling poorly about themselves, you know, that pervasive shame, building up their self-esteem so that that shame will reduce a little bit. Yeah, working on their attachment. It's a really, really interesting and very, very important part of work, and it takes time. And with children in particular, no child is going to trust someone as soon as they walk in the door. So it's all that relationship building all the time, and it can be very slow progress. But I can say from, you know, looking at my own children that it does work.
So I guess lastly, this has been such an amazing discussion and I've got so much out of it, and I hope, you know, the listeners I'm sure that they will as well. Do you have any, recommended resources? Basically, I know you mentioned Gabor Mate, with the Hold On To Your Kids. We've got, you know, anyone can look up the Dan Hughes parenting model.
There's also TBRI, which came out of the States, which is trust-based relational interventions. They're all attachment-based. That's another way of creating opportunities to engage with your children and manage those difficult behaviours. Deborah Gray is another interesting resource. Attaching and Adoption was one that I read earlier on in my career. And I think she's a social worker as well. And she is very practical. The tools that she implements and advises you on are really nice, practical, because often you can read and do all this research, but then how do you take that and implement it in your family when, you know, your children are having meltdowns or they're, you know, you're getting phone calls from school all the time and nothing seems to be working? You need practical tools as well. There was also quite an interesting book from CASE, Centre for Adoption Support and Education in the States, called Beneath the Mask, which was Understanding Adopted Teens. And I've done some work with them. So Deb Riley wrote that one. And that talked, you know, there's case studies in there as well and treatment considerations for therapists and parents as well, because it does get tricky when they become teens. So they're just some of the ones, I guess, that I rely on.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been amazing just chatting with you. And, yeah, it's been great to speak about this topic, and I think it's important. And, yeah, I think the more stories and experience that knowledge that people have, I think the more that we can kind of create that community, more of like an online community presence as well.
Very important to stay connected and to not give up hope. You know, there's learned hopefulness, I guess, and you can, you know, really turn the tables on things and think, wow, okay, light bulb moment. He may not have gone to school very much this week, but he made it for one morning. That's okay for this week. That's a little bit of a shift. That's a little bit of a win.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for sharing your story. If you would like to learn more about Elizabeth or are seeking help around anything adoption, out-of-home care, therapeutic parenting related, you can reach Liz via email through her website, familyfoundationscounselling.com, where Zoom sessions can be arranged. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on My Unknown Truth.